Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our distinguished guest today is Daniel Kahneman, who is the Eugene Higgins Professor of Psychology at Princeton University and Professor of Psychology and Public Affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. In 2002, he received the Nobel Prize in Economics for his work with Amos Tversky on human judgment and decision-making. A former professor of psychology at Berkeley, he is the Hitchcock Professor in the spring 2007. Professor Kahneman, welcome to back to Berkeley.
Thank you.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Tel Aviv, which was then Palestine, and I was raised in France until the age of 12 when we went back to Palestine.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, you know, I grew up in a Jewish environment, and I think my mother had more to do with shaping my view of the world in some ways than my father. My father was a researcher, but my mother certainly influenced my development. She was very interested in people, and I lived in a world that consisted of people and words, really. I was never very interested in nature or in animals, but people and words I was really fascinated by from an early age.
And you were in Europe, in France, during the war. Did that, I would imagine that experience really had an impact on your thinking, or did it?
Well, you know, undoubtedly it shaped me. I don't know what I would have been without that experience, but certainly, you know, I went through a lot of experiences that more fortunate children don't have, and I was luckier than most of the children of my generation in that place in the world.
You describe in your official autobiography, The Nobel Laureate, an incident where you were coming home once. Would you mind retelling that story?
Oh, yeah.
It's quite fascinating.
Well, it must have been the fall of 41, I think, where there was a curfew for Jews. We were all supposed to be wearing a yellow star. And there was a curfew, which I think was 6 p.m., and I was in first or second grade. And I'd gone to play with a friend, and I was going home, and I missed the curfew. I was late. And so I turned my sweater inside out and walked home. And as I was coming close, I remember that the street was deserted, and there was this German soldier walking towards me, and he was wearing the black uniform, and I knew that that was not good. That was the uniform of the SS. And we were walking towards each other, and as we were coming close, he sort of beckoned me, and of course I went there, and he picked me up and hugged me. And I remember being terrified, you know, that he would see the Star of David inside my sweater. And then he put me down and took out his wallet and showed me a picture of a boy and gave me some money. And that, yeah, I mean, you know, that's a formative memory in a way, because of what it meant about the complexity of things. I mean, I remember being very fascinated at the time by this and by stories of, you know, Hitler liking flowers and, you know, kissing babies. And the complexity of evil was much on my mind as a 7 or 8 year old, I think.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the in retrospect, the expectation about what somebody like that would do if he were rational and following the orders of his organization.
It was more the complexity, yeah, of the moment and the basic humanity of the fellow. I mean, who was clearly quite capable of being inhumane at other times, and I think already knew this, but was a father, and a lonely father, and with a boy, and I reminded him of the boy, and I could, you know, I knew that immediately.
After the war, you and your mother emigrated to Israel.
Indeed.
Yes. And any memories from that experience of having that chance to go to Israel and be there and during that very formative period in Israel?
Well, that was, you know, for me it was, of course, an enormous change because I was lucky. I was held up a year. I had been, you know, quite Jewish and feeble in athletics and a bit precocious intellectually and so on. And in Israel, everything was different. I had basically a normal adolescence, and I was very grateful for that. The period, of course, was a very exciting period. You know, I mean, it was. We went there in 1946. Actually, we went there. I think we arrived the day that the famous bombing of the King David Hotel, which was an important event in that story. Then in 1948, there was the war. And in 1951, I started my studies. And in 1954, I myself went into the army. So it was all quite compressed in time.
And you were educated at Hebrew University?
Yes, indeed.
Right. And what was your major?
Psychology. And my minor was mathematics.
Mm-hmm. And then you went into the Army and really became a researcher there. Talk a little about that.
Well, yeah. I mean, first, actually, I spent a year, which probably in many ways was at least as important. I spent a year as a platoon commander, which was quite, you know, those things change you. And then I was a psychologist. And it was a period where there was no psychology department. The professor of psychology had been killed in the 1948 war, and there was nothing. And the head of the research unit in the psychological research unit was a chemist. I mean, and here it was completely self-taught. Mm. But the place was full of brilliant people, and there was a lot of very good work being done. And I was, as it were, the best-trained psychologist. I had a BA, which I had proudly acquired in, I think, 2 years. I was the best-trained psychologist there, and I did a number of things that had a big influence on my development later. So one of the things I did do that I'm still quite proud of, actually, is I set up an interviewing system for the Israeli army to interview recruits for combat units. And that, it turns out, I learned in 2002, that interview is still in place 50 years later. Mm. And so they have barely changed it, in fact. So I had many experiences that were formative in terms of my subsequent research on judgment.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about that interview. What the problem before you was to match the skill set with the requirements of the job. Talk a little about that and your thought processes. Here you are, a young person with only a BA, and yet you're putting in place a formula that works
well,
through time.
It turns out, and you know, that's a bit of history of my field in psychology, that in 1954, Paul Meehl, a very famous psychologist who died just a few years ago, published a very important book in which he showed that clinicians are much less good at what they're doing than they think they are, and that their ability to predict, forecast events and psychological behavior in the future is really quite limited. And I must have read that book, because what I did to set up the interview system, you know, was, I have no memory of reading the book, but I must have read it. Because what I did was completely compatible with what he advised. And I created, I don't think I could do it much better today. I set up an interview where people were asked, that didn't leave a lot of room for clinical intuition on part of the interviewer. Mm. The interviewer went through a script and found out what the person had done as a civilian, basically. And it turns out that when you use that information to produce ratings on various traits, and you get ratings that are predictive and are useful, you know, on whether somebody is responsible, appreciates, you know, manliness or things like that, is sociable. And in addition, it turned out, and that came, you know, that was important to me years later, it turned out that when people had acquired that information, then their clinical judgment was in fact good. Mm-hmm. Whereas if they were trying to form a clinical impression, they couldn't do it. Now, these observations that I made at that time became really quite essential to my research about 15 years later, and they were central to, you know, to the work that ultimately led to the Nobel Prize and so on. Mm-hmm. So it started quite early, and, you know, by accident, of course.
I'm interested in exploring with you the skills that make for a psychologist. In other words, this interface between skill set and the requirements of the discipline. Talk a little about that, because I think students often want to know, well, what does it take to do that? I want to do that.
Well, you know, I think you must enjoy observing things, and you must, and that must be true, you know, for so people who do zoology or biology must enjoy observing other things. I like observing people, and probably for a psychologist it also helps a lot to examine yourself. So I think many of the best ideas that I've had have come from examining events in my life. Mm-hmm. And examining how I respond to events in my life. Hmm. And so that's been, you know, a source of, you know, ideas. Inspiration is too big a word, but certainly a source of ideas. Then what you learn in, you know, in the course of a career is you learn not to ask questions that are so big that there are no answers to them. Mm-hmm. So you look for questions that can be answered. But you look for questions that have a twist to them, that are somehow interesting. And, you know, and I've been lucky. I've had a few of those. I think that, you know, I think of research as a conversation. And it's very much like a conversation. Nobody, no single person dominates it. But what does happen is when you interject something, when you contribute something to a conversation, you want to be understood, you want to be heard, you would like people to pay attention, you would like it to have some influence on the way the conversation goes. You don't control it. But thinking in conversational terms of, and trying to say something that is interesting as a criterion, not merely publishable, but actually interesting, you know, that's been part of, you know, what moved me.
As I listen to you talk, I have the sense of kind of there is an element of humanity in your research design. In other words, I think the Jewish expression would be seichel, that you part of what you've done in your work is to find simple questions that then really open up the conversation. Is that fair?
Well, I mean, I think it's fair. I think, though, that you know, I was drawn to a particular kind of research, but actually I was inspired by research that I read as a very young, you know, professor. I read a work by somebody who was a very famous psychologist, Walter Mischel, and I read his thesis, I think must have been 1964. And in his thesis, he had asked children a single question. I think he had two questions, but one was, there is that fairy or magician who can make of you whatever you want to be. What do you want to be? And then if they said, you know, a profession or some trait that has to do with achievement, it was scored one, otherwise zero. He would give them two lollipops, a large one and a small one. And he would say, you can have this one now or that one tomorrow. And now it turned out that the answers of children to those two questions predicted everything in sight. I mean, it was really those. And I was enormously impressed by that. And I called that the psychology of single questions. And it turned out to be an ideal for me of doing research about single questions, of having single examples. And a few years later, you know, I was fortunate enough to be able to do the psychology of single questions. And I have largely kept to that. Kept to very simple points, making very simple points.
An important theme in your work is your collaboration with Amos Zversky, and you talked quite a bit about that in your autobiography for the Nobel Prize. It was very fascinating. I'd like to talk a little about that, because it was a friendship in which the conversation was really, had great depth between the two of you, and then really impacted the field. Talk a little about the elements of that relationship.
Well, I think we're both very lucky in a way, but I certainly consider myself extraordinarily lucky. We were close enough so we understood each other very well, and we also had complementary skills. So, I'm more intuitive than he was. He was really renowned for his clarity and, just incredible clarity and ability to see the big picture. And I'm more of an intellectual fumbler, but I dig fairly deep. And I also have wild flights of fancy. And the combination of those two, of his characteristics and mine, and the fact that we just got along very well and had enormous respect for each other, and that we enjoyed each other's company. So that, I think we knew it. We had jointly, we sort of had a mind that was better than our separate minds. And, our joint mind was very, very good. I'm not embarrassed to say that. It was much better than mine. So we did very good work that way. And there was something in the dynamic that is especially interesting, I think, to me, which is that when you think on your own as a scientist, as a researcher, it sometimes takes years before you understand what you're saying. So you first say something, you write it, it can be published. And only years later you say, oh, I really said that. It was there. It was in my mind. Now, when there are two of you conversing, that process is short-circuited. It's quite dramatic. So I would say vague things, and Amos would hear them, and he would see what I meant much more clearly than I had when I said it. And I think that was really part of the secret of our success, was that together, through that process of understanding each other better than the speaker had understood himself, we could make a lot of progress relatively. We also had, infinite patience, and we enjoyed spending 6 hours a day together. So,
And I think at one point you say that you would have a thought and he could finish it, basically.
Well, I mean, when you spend 6 hours a day with someone for a number of years, we knew each other's jokes, and of course we could finish each other's thoughts, but we kept surprising each other. So, there was enough. So we became very efficient, I think.
You use the term a conversation. This is a subset of that. Now, before we talk about the research that you got the prize for, there's a intriguing element in your story, which is you're a psychologist and you won the prize for economics. And I guess what's of interest is, what are your thoughts about the fact that you were working in one discipline and were recognized, but then disciplines always have boundaries that want to limit the conversation, but then the power of what you were saying not only affected psychology, but also economics. That was kind of unique in a way. A little about that.
The first place, the element of luck was considerable in that development. It didn't have to be that way. And there was luck at several stages. There was something that Amos and I did together, which had something to do with the psychology of single questions, which caused many people to pay attention to our work. And that was that we would publish our questions that basically explored flaws in humans' intuitive thinking. But our questions were very simple, and each one made a point, and they were part of the articles we published. And that turned out to be quite important to what happened to us, because the readers would read this, and then the errors were not the errors of somebody else, you know, of some subjects. Mm-hmm. They knew, they could recognize in themselves that, oh, yes, you know, this is the way my mind works. So we were, I think, you know, this was almost part of our rhetoric, not of the substance. But the rhetoric was very effective. So we had some economists paying attention to our work early on. Then when we worked on decision-making, which was the second thing we did together, we published a theory paper in Econometrica, which is, you know, the prestige theory journal in economics. Now, we were not intending to influence economics at all. It was just the best journal for the kind of articles. Now, if we had published exactly the same article in Psychological Review, I would not have got the Nobel Prize. So that's, you know, it was a trivial detail. Mm-hmm. If we'd had a hostile referee in Econometrica, we would have gone to Psych Review and so. But the big event that caused the prize is that some economists were interested. So in particular, someone who is, you know, now my closest friend, Richard Thaler, who is an economist, he became interested in our work. And he is the one who both taught me personally economics and brought these ideas into economics, where they are behavioral finance. So it's because of the work of economists that I got the prize. I didn't get the prize, you know, for work that Amos and I did, you know, just because it was very good work. We got the prize, or I got the prize because he couldn't share in it, because it had impact on economics. But the impact was because people in economics saw it was relevant. And there were a minority of people, and they did brilliant work.
Does this tell us anything about, you know, new ideas and disciplines, that a general proposition that innovation maybe sometimes has to come from outside?
Well, what I learned, and that was something I knew, you know, I mean, I remember we were approached, Amos Tversky and I were approached by the person who is now the president of the Russell Sage Foundation, Eric Warner, very early in the 1980s, almost 25 years ago, and he asked us what could be done, exactly 25 years ago, he asked us what could be done to bring psychology and economics together. And I remember something I told him then. I said this was not a project on which we could spend a lot of money, honestly. And I told him that there was absolutely no point encouraging psychologists to influence economics. But that if there were economists who were interested, he should support them. And indeed, 2 years later, Richard Thaler, whose name I mentioned, came to spend a year with me in Vancouver. And we had a glorious year, and we published a number of articles together, some of them quite important, actually. And that was the beginning of behavioral economics.
Mm-hmm. Looking back, what comments would you like to make about creativity, if any? In other words, from what we just talked about, is there some point to be made that would help us understand that? But we've talked about collaboration, we've talked about research design, and then this funny set of information or thinking passing from one discipline to another.
Well, people have very different tastes, you know, and intellectually they have different tastes and they have different skill sets and so on. So, you know, I know where my ideas come from and pretty much what characterizes them. They're very simple. So I tend to see simple things. And sometimes I see some simple things that other people haven't seen before, but I don't see very complicated things. And other people have, you know, are better at seeing complicated things. So there are different kinds of creativity. And together with Tversky, we had a range of possibilities because he was creative in different ways than I was.
Let's talk a little now about your research and I know that prize I think is built on a whole body of research, but I think it would be useful for our audience to understand the very simple ideas, if I can use your words, that had such power and such impact. In your lecture, you said the mind is a system of jumps to conclusions,
yeah.
And you're looking at one piece of that.
Well, yes. I mean, what we studied was intuitive thinking in the domain of judgment under uncertainty. This is how we started. That is, how do people assess the probabilities of events, and how do they forecast the future intuitively? And our idea was that people use heuristics, which are basically shortcuts. And in my lecture, it's a phrase I coined this week, but I'm going to use it.
Mm-hmm.
I did speak of the mind as a machine for jumping to conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
And we figured out some of the ways that this is done. And I think the most important one that we studied in the first years of our work was something that I now call substitution. That is, you're asked a difficult question, you cannot answer it, but another answer comes to mind, and it's an answer to a related question, which is simpler. And without being aware of it, you substitute the answer for the simple question in place of the answer to the complicated one. And this is how, you know, lay people and non-experts come up with intuitions about very complicated problems that baffle experts. Some of these intuitions are good, others are not so good, but that's the machinery. So that was the first part of our work on judgment, was basically developing that idea and fleshing it out.
And as your thinking about these issues has developed over time, you're really focusing on perception, intuition and cognition, right? Is perception, emotion, and cognition?
Well, it started out, you know, the period when we were working was the heyday of what is called the cognitive revolution. So at the time, psychologists were all engaged in exploring the mysteries of cognition, and we were no exception. And one novel aspect of what we were doing was that we imported the notion of illusion from perception into cognition.
Mm-hmm.
And so we showed that people make errors of intuitive thinking that have many of the characteristics of illusions. That was because I was teaching perception at the time. This was what filled my mind. And so the analogy of visual perception and how it helps inform how we think about intuition, that's been very important to my thinking all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
And I have explored this idea in particular over the last 5 or 6 years.
Now talk a little about what you call System 1 intuition. In other words, people realize they do the sorts of things you're describing, but it's your description, the description that has developed, is really an important balance when one just focuses on what you call System 2, which is rationality.
Well, you know, this is something that I have, that has become explicit in my mind only recently. I mean, it's one of the things you learn is that some ideas are taken for granted. So, for example, when we worked, we took rationality, that people are able to compute correct answers to problems. That did not need explaining, so we were not looking at that. We were looking at mistakes. But when the field accepted the notion of mistakes, then it became a challenge that people were sometimes able to figure things out and to do it correctly. And the resolution of that, which I think is becoming widespread, it's not original to me, this is just generally accepted in psychology, is that there are those two families of mental processes. So I call them, along with others, it's not my term either, System 1 and System 2, one of which is the intuitive, rapid, associative, uncontrolled, automatic kind of thinking, and the other one is the rule-governed, you know, that's the way you fill your income tax form or compute 17th time 24 or read a map. And so we're able to think in this way, but most of the time we run on the software of System 1, that is, automatically and with little thought, and by and large, with remarkable success and accuracy.
In an interview somewhere, which I read with you, you said, with fear, probability does not matter as much. The more emotional event, the less sensible people are.
Well, this is a development of the last 10 or 15 years. So the cognitive revolution is now over. And what is happening in the field is that emotion is now being, you know. So the views of decision-making have changed. And in a way, they're going back to what was common, you know, 60, 70, 80 years ago. That is to the idea that there are very important conflicts between reason and passion. Now, you know, that idea was, nobody was thinking along those lines 20 years ago, but many people are thinking along those lines today. And so the idea that one of the operations of System 1, that is one of the attributes that are constantly being evaluated by System 1, is the emotional significance of events. So we're continuously evaluating whether things are good or bad or safe or threatening and so on. And our emotional responses guide us, and our emotional responses guide the ideas that come to our minds. So,
well, in one thing that I read, possibly in the autobiography, the issue arose that very important to your work is the way one defines a problem, and I guess in your that is the problem you're researching. So that the in the area of risk and loss, for example, your thinking, as I understand it, sort of opened up our understanding of how people perceive risk and loss in economic decision making, because previously the focus had been just on wealth, that is the entire fortune that was at stake.
Well, you know, again, it's a very simple idea, but it is true that, you know, I think for 300 years, the focus in the analysis of decision, of financial decisions, decisions about money, has been about wealth. So people have talked about the utility of wealth, which is what is the psychological response to wealth, and that people evaluate different prospects and opportunities by evaluating them in terms of what is called finite states of wealth. Now, when I started studying this field under, you know, under the tutelage actually of Amos Tversky, who had studied it, it was not my specialty, I was struck by the absurdity of it. And I was struck by the fact that this is not the way that people think about risk. They think about risk in terms of gains and losses. You don't know what wealth you have. Now, it turns out that that is a very fundamental reorganization of the field. If you think that outcomes are in terms of gains and losses and not in terms of final states. So it opened up a whole agenda that people are still working out.
What I hear you saying, and I don't mean to repeat myself, but that by kind of narrowing the focus, by having an intuition about the way people are or the way you are, as you said, this is really central to what's going on in your work.
Well, you know, there are several stages to this, so this idea of gains and losses and that people evaluate changes, you know, that I distinctly remember how I had that idea. So I was reading a chapter in a book that Amos Tversky was one of the authors of that book, and it was a chapter on how people analyze decisions. Many important philosophers had been analyzing the so-called the utility function for money. And I noticed that they never asked people about wealth. They said, what about a gamble in which you could win that amount with a certain probability or get that amount for sure? Or they didn't do loss as much, but it was all about changes. And I came back to Amos and I said, hey, what's going on here? I mean, they are asking questions about this and then they're plotting a function in terms of that. So that is psychologically very implausible. So, you know, you need to be able to pay attention to this. And then then you need to realize that it's important. I mean, so on the very day, you know, it was obvious that we would never look at wealth again, you know, that we were going to do something that is psychologically realistic, because he was immediately convinced. You know, somebody else had had that idea before, but they hadn't followed through with it, and we did. So you need a very simple idea, and then you need to see that it's important. Mm-hmm. Then you need to follow through, and it's a combination of tools.
I'm curious, because people listening to your lecture, listening to you now, the question is: does your research offer insights to individuals with regard to how they might change their own behavior?
Well, yes, you know, potentially it does, but they're not insights that are very easy to use. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can be aware of mistakes you make. And it's very difficult to learn to avoid them, because System 1 operates automatically. Occasionally, when a decision is very important, then you can stop to think. And you have to recognize that, you know, you can stop to think. And then, you know, there is still the extra stage, which is a very painful and difficult stage of, even if, you know, your analysis tells you to do something, when you don't want to do it, mm-hmm. You know, to impose the discipline of rationality on your desires is extremely difficult. I mean, I've just lived something like this, you know, in deciding whether or not to write a book. And I just want to do it. When I analyze, you know, the pros and cons, it's absurd for me to do this, but I'm going to do it, I think. So, you know, it's very difficult to impose discipline on yourself.
In your lecture, you talked about individuals, a fireman, a nurse, who essentially develop an intuition that is critical to their career and their being able to see things. Talk a little about that, because you are approaching the question of how a person develops over time and kind of masters their intuition.
Well, I was citing, you know, one of the important developments in recent years in my life has been, you know, I try to understand controversy, and I try to reduce controversy. And so we have, Amos Tversky and I, you know, we made our reputation by finding flaws in what people do. You know, it was the method we used. It's not that we ever thought that people are stupid, but this is what we were doing. Now, many people have responded to that by saying that we're drawing a distorted picture of human nature. And one of the people who responded to that, his name is Gary Klein, and he is the guru of a movement that is called natural decision making, and they're very much interested in intuition and, you know, and deliberately skeptical about the kind of work that we've done. And so I approached him because I liked his work, actually. And we've been collaborating on an article. So I was citing in my lecture examples from his work, mm-hmm. in professional intuitions, that as a fireman, on, you know, a captain of a firefighting company on the roof, suddenly yelling to his company, "Let's get out of here!" And just before the house explodes, and then it turns out he wasn't aware of where he was doing it, but his feet were warm, and that was the cue that triggered, you know, the sense that something very dangerous is going on just underneath them. That's a beautiful example of a perfect intuition, and that's the kind of thing that has been feeding, you know, people who think that, you know, all our discussions of biases and mistakes are overstated. So it sets a very interesting problem that Gary Klein and I have been trying to sort out together. When do intuitions develop and when don't they? Which experts can you trust and which experts shouldn't you trust?
Mm-hmm. In my notes for your lecture, you said that skills are acquired in an environment of feedback and opportunity for learning in a social network. So that would help us understand, you know, what makes it possible for the fireman to be that way.
I mean, you know, they think about situations a lot, and they talk about things a lot. So they develop models of various kinds of fires. They don't have to experience, you know, we are really capable of learning a great deal from simulated experience. So, Even athletes can learn from simulating things in their mind, and they do. They practice a lot at night, you know, without doing anything. So this is, you know, one piece of machinery that we dispose of. It will not help you in certain domains. Like, it's not something that a CIA analyst can do, because mm-hmm. the system that they deal with are fundamentally more complicated.
Mm-hmm. Which raises the interesting question of how groups can learn from their own experience. And so your work is related to decision-making in the marketplace. And in a minute, we'll talk about your article on foreign policy. And in those cases, what is the difference when you have institutions and groups that would like to correct these kinds of errors?
Well, you know, in the first place, my main observation would be that groups, by and large, do not correct errors.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a recurrent observation. You know, there is a lot of lip service paid in organizations about improving the quality of our intelligence and the quality of our decision-making. But I think it's mainly lip service.
Mm-hmm.
Because imposing a discipline on decision-making, you know, as I illustrated by my example of the book, you know, I don't want to impose discipline on my decision-making. And so the leaders of organizations, both civilian and, you know, governmental and, you know, commercial, they don't like to be second-guessed. And so by and large, it's the rare leader, you know, and there are very salient examples, but, you know, like the Bay of Pigs, mm-hmm. After the Bay of Pigs. Well, it's mainly actually not the Bay of Pigs. It's the Cuban Missile Crisis is the example that people think about, as where somebody really, the President Kennedy, developed a team, a deliberating team that was superbly efficient in allowing dissent and in allowing ideas and in slowing down the process of decision-making to a rate that was appropriate to the complexity of the situation. That's very rare.
Mm-hmm. And in some domains, for example, politics, the name of the game becomes not to do what the other party, did and how they learned. Now, recently you had an article in Foreign Policy which, in a way, applying your analysis to foreign policy decision-making is pessimistic in the sense that it suggests that hawks have a structural advantage in the sense that the choices that they lean toward whatever the issue basically fall into many of the categories that you've identified in individual decision-making.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think it's significant. I think it's probably true. I didn't expect to see this, but when I made a list of the biases of human thinking then and decision-making, it turned out that in a situation of conflict, when conflict is about to develop or arise, then these biases very consistently, I thought, favor hawks over doves, so that the claims of hawks will resonate with emotions and beliefs and things that people want to believe mm-hmm. more than the claims of doves. And that was the point of that article.
And in fact, that there's an optimistic bias. Well, we have all of this military hardware. And an illusion of control. We can go in there, you know, and by defeating the adversary, you know, we can then take control.
I mean, clearly, you know, it's very clear whenever you look at a serious conflict or a war, there was enormous optimism, usually on both sides. It's not only the losing side that was optimistic. It was the winning side didn't appreciate the costs. And that, I think, is regularly true. I mean, it's very difficult to think of a conflict in which anybody had any idea when mm-hmm. it began how bad it was going to be for both sides. And so you need... Now, of course, it is the case that when conflict breaks out, then there has been optimism. But almost by definition, you get optimism on both sides of every conflict. And when conflict arises, I think the tendency, you know, pessimism becomes disloyalty. So that doubting our ability to achieve victory, it would take a very, very strong national leader to be able to sustain some doubter in his inner circle when he himself wants to move forward.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, in terms of where we are now, it's difficult to cut losses. I know that if one has a fund, a mutual fund that has not done well, one doesn't want to move it for fear that you will lose even more by rationally moving it.
People in general don't like cutting their losses, and they're willing to gamble on in the hope of, you know, recovering their losses. And that is a very well-known characteristic of individual decision-making. And in national decision-making, it's exacerbated because the national leaders who have led a country, you know, to close to defeat, for them, there is really nothing further to be lost by putting more at risk. Mm-hmm. And so there is a real divergence of interest between national leaders and their communities when the time to cut losses arrives, because cutting losses is very rarely beneficial to the decision maker.
I would be interested in your reflections on human nature, actually, because you've actually devoted a whole career to looking at the quirks of our personalities, the blind spots in our rational thinking. Did you start with the same view? Have you ended up in the same place that you started with? You started, you said, with complexity. You know, this interaction with this soldier in the streets of Paris. You there was complexity. Is that where you still are? And has anything come out of your research that has informed whatever view of human nature you had?
Well, you know, again, they're different intellectual styles, so. There are some people who summarize, you know, the world in, can summarize it in one big idea. That's not the way my mind works. So I think there is some coherence in my view of the way people work. But, you know, I have built things, you know, one brick at a time. And I don't think, you know, I have a simple summary. I can, in general, find pretty good arguments to reject any simple idea about human nature, but it's not that I have a simple idea of my own to substitute for it. So in that sense, yes, complexity is my message.
Now, if students were to watch this program, do you have any advice for them about how they should prepare for their future if, for example, they want to go into the field of psychology?
Well, you know, my main advice would be to look at the natural traps that await anybody who does research. And one of the real traps is to get trapped by a research program that is fundamentally uninteresting. And also a reluctance to cut your losses, so that when you've done something that is not very interesting, wasting time trying to publish it is almost always a big mistake, so at least in my judgment. So looking for things that are worth doing and discarding things that don't work, you know, and knowing that, you know, if you're reasonably good at what you're doing, and otherwise you shouldn't be in that profession, but if you're reasonably good at it, then ideas are a dime a dozen. You know, you get lots of ideas. You need some ideas that work and that keep you excited and that you can do something with. And so not getting stuck on an idea that doesn't work, but, you know, looking for other ideas is, you know, that would be my general advice. That certainly has been how I've operated.
Yeah, at the end of your autobiography, you go back to your relationship with Amos Tversky, and you quote him, and I thought that these were both very interesting comments. You say that, but the other side of freedom is the ability to find joy in what one does and the ability to adapt creatively to the inevitable. And then you go on to tell us that he often said, let us take what the terrain gives.
Well, you know, this was a graveside eulogy for Tversky. I mean, when he died in 1996. So that's the context in which... So adapting to the inevitable, I was commenting on how he managed his death, which was really an exemplary... He really did quite extraordinary things in managing his dying. Let's take what the terrain gives, was the expression of his wisdom as a researcher, you know, in his latter years. And it's the idea that you cannot really define in advance the problem that you're going to solve. If you decide that I'm going to solve this problem, you're not going to do it. Mm-hmm. What you do is you are in that area and you do the best you can. You take what the terrain gives and you adapt to what it is that you can find out. And you don't try to force your ideas on nature. You are guided by what is achievable. Mm-hmm. And... yeah, that's it's, you know, it's very good advice for some people, but it was very good advice for him, better than for me, for example. But yeah, that was his intellectual style.
And you mentioned, and then the final question, you mentioned that you might do another book. Is there a piece of research, an agenda that you still want to pursue in the next phase?
I've been working for the last 10-12 years on issues of well-being and experience and measuring experience. And the book that I'm thinking about is actually a trade book. I don't know if it will happen at my age, you never know. But it would really cover the main topics that I've worked on, because, you know, I've given a lot of public lectures and I like talking to lay audiences, and in general, I like thinking simply about the things I do. And so I thought it would be a good opportunity to put things together. So I think I'm going to try to do this.
And do your insights about intuition apply, or are they useful foundation for understanding what makes us happy? Or is it a separate...
No, I think it's a separate... I mean, there are, there is a lot in common, because there are certain mistakes that we make in anticipating, what will and will not make us happy. And these mistakes really are very well understood by the notion of substitution that I mentioned earlier. So we make highly predictable errors in thinking about our future, about what makes us happy, about what makes other people happy.
On that note, Professor Kahneman, I want to thank you very much for coming back to Berkeley and for appearing on our program. Thank you very much. And thank you for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.